talking about gold in them hills. And I told you at the beginning of the program that I am I'm hooked on treasure stories. I love lost treasure stories, lost mines, lost fortunes. I have enjoyed those tales since probably I was a kid reading Treasure Island. And we're about to hear some real-life treasure stories. W.C. Jameson has been a treasure hunter for more than 50 years. He's fallen from cliffs, had ropes break during climbs, been caught in mineshaft cave-ins, contended with flash floods, been shot at, watched men die, had to deal with rattlesnakes, water moccasins, scorpions, centipedes. He's fled for his life from park rangers, policemen, landowners, competitors, corporate mercenaries, and drug runners. And he's not only pursued treasure, he's found it, a lot of it. His story, if half of this is true, it should be a movie or a series of movies. It's an intriguing and entertaining book called Treasure Hunter, and W.C. Jameson joins us in just a moment. Welcome back. W.C. Jameson is an award-winning and best-selling author of books, articles, and essays. He's also a singer, songwriter, and performer. He's got 5 albums of original music out. He's been in 5 films. He's written soundtracks, but mostly he's known as a treasure hunter. He's been on programs like Unsolved Mysteries, on the Travel Channel, Discovery Channel, Nightline, NPR, has won several awards for writing. And I can tell you this, the book that we're going to talk about tonight, Treasure Hunter, which is a memoir about his life chasing lost loot, is a page turner. It's great to have you here. First time on the program, and I hope you hope we get a chance to have you back again. I can tell you, I really enjoyed your book, W.C.
Well, thank you, and good morning.
You know, it seems to me, I didn't read it in the book, but I read it somewhere, that you were an advisor to or involved with the movie when it came out, the National Treasure movie?
Yes, and they sent me the script and asked me to comment on it. And, of course, told him it was pretty absurd. It doesn't really happen that way, but boy, it was entertaining as heck.
Like I said, if half of the stories in your book are true, even if they're only slightly exaggerated, it's been an amazing ride for you. My gosh. Let's start with how you got hooked on it. The story you tell about going into a field to get some strawberries.
Right. I was 7 years old, and I had a hat into a neighbor's yard and pilfering fresh strawberries. And while I was in the act of gorging myself on strawberries, the neighbor, along with 3 friends of his, all professional treasure hunters, by the way, came out on the back porch, turned the light on, and they were talking about they had a map, and they were going in search of a cave that allegedly contained 100, I think if I got this right, 100 gold ingots. I was fascinated by this, and I hid in the strawberry patch there, I listened to this dialogue going back and forth with these guys, but they caught me. They found me in the strawberry patch, and they basically conscripted me. They didn't want me to tell anybody what I heard, so they took me with them on a hunt. They left the next morning. They took me on their hunt, and I basically served as a shore boy and watched.
Hey, W.C., we're having trouble hearing you. I don't know if you're on a cell phone, but if you could put it up.
I'm on a cell. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can. If you hold it close to your mouth, because you're breaking up a little bit. So
okay.
We'll see if
where did you leave me?
Well, we can hear you. So they catch you in the act, and then inscript you and take you into the cause to help them find this treasure, right?
Right. We went to they took me to the Guadalupe Mountains of West Texas. In fact, I'll be going out there next week. I did get to accompany them during their search, and I was involved in, they found the gold ingots, and I was involved in the recovery. It could be helpful to them.
So what was this gold worth?
I had no idea at the time. A little research years later.
Yeah, we're having a hard time hearing you. So
okay, gold at that time was for $32 an ounce.
I'll tell you what, we're going to have to figure something else out here because we're getting about every third word from you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can be just fine.
Well, we'll just keep plugging away here and see if it gets better. I don't know if there's a spot where your cell phone works better, or we'll just have to try to. All right. Gina Salvati on our phones is going to try to call him back and see if we can get a better connection here. As I mentioned, W.C. Jameson has spent more than 50 years chasing different treasure, and the kinds of information that comes his way is astounding, because he not only has chased it and sometimes been successful, but he's found a heck of a lot of it. And it's apparently earned him enough to pay for a home, to pay for his own education, to put away money for his children's education. And it's earned him notoriety. He says in the book, he explains that basically the success or failure of a treasure hunt starts in the library, that the more research you do, the better chance you have of success. So his adventures have always started in the library with getting basic facts about, you know how it goes with these treasure stories. There's little bits of factual. All right. WC, are you back?
I'm back. Can you hear me?
Great. Yeah, I think we got it solved, I hope. So you guys, those guys who are with you, they find a whole big bunch of gold. You don't get a piece of it, though. You didn't get a piece of it.
I get none of it, no.
But you were hooked.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was this incredible sensation being involved with handling these gold ingots. I sort of had a feeling at the time that I was going to be doing something associated with this for much of the rest of my life. And that turned out to be true.
I was mentioning during the break there, while you were trying to solve the phone problems, that you write in the beginning of this book that really the success or failure deals a lot with what happens in the library before you set out on these adventures.
Indeed. Most of my expeditions associated with treasure hunting start out with research and investigation. And I guess over the years I've learned that about if you invest about 90% of your efforts into preparation, we're talking about situational research, site research, by the time you get into the field, your chances of success are enhanced considerably.
You write in the book that you've achieved a level of notoriety and fame, and it's a mixed blessing. I guess it helps in one sense, in that people will call you up and tell you their treasure stories, but that is also a mixed blessing in that you get pestered a lot.
I do. In most cases, it's kind of a nice pestering, but I get a lot of contacts from people that basically want me to tell them where some treasure is so that they can go find it, thinking that it's that easy. And I try to be kind and tell them they got a little work to do, but and there are some that they basically tell me they say to me, tell me where this is or else. I think this is why there's a delete button on the computer.
Huh. Every once in a while, though, somebody calls up, they tell you a treasure story, and something clicks in your head, and you say to yourself, that sounds like it might be legit, right?
Oh yeah, I do get I get good leads every once in a while. A lot of times via email, and a lot of times during every once in a while I do talks about this sort of thing. And every once in a while I'll meet something interesting who has a compelling story or a compelling connection to a lost mine or a buried treasure.
Give us a sense of how much treasure is out there, because I get the feeling that there's a lot more treasure stories than there is actual treasure.
I think you're probably right, but there is a great deal of treasure out there. We have had, over the 60 years or so that I've been doing this, we have had a number of impressive successes. We've had a bunch of failures, too. Any treasure hunter that tells you that they find something every time they go out is lying to you. We've had some successes, but if you've been paying attention to this lately, you'll notice that about every week or every two or three weeks, there's something in the newspaper or on television about somebody encountering a lost mine or a lost treasure or a buried treasure. There's a lot of activity off the East Coast right now, people locating sunken wrecks and harvesting the gold and the silver and the artifacts that went down in hurricanes or battles or whatever.
Yeah, there are a lot of those kind of stories. And here in the Southwest, especially the Western states, there's all kinds of lost mines and fortunes and things that disappeared in a storm. And for you, the first job, I would think, is separating fact from fiction. What is a legend and what's real? So you got to research, did treasure actually disappear? Did a caravan disappear? Did a wagon disappear? That sort of thing, right?
Right. You look for, I've done this enough times, I look for some historical connections, some geographical veracity associated with all of this. Anybody can tell a story, and a lot of these stories can be dismissed out of hand. But every once in a while, you come across a tale, or either in print or something that somebody tells you, where there's just enough to get the blood flowing, to get you interested in it. And sometimes there's a payoff. A lot of times, by the time you do enough research on this, these are discarded. But every once in a while, to use the old cliche, there's a gold nugget among the acorns.
You have a chapter called Ingots of Gold, Threats of Death. Tell me about this treasure story. This is the 1960s. You're living in Texas.
I was in, refresh my mind. I've written over 100 books, so I'm not sure exactly.
There was a lady named Noss, Mrs. Noss.
Oh, okay, yeah, all right. That was associated with this fascinating treasure that was found by Miss Noss's husband, who was shot and killed over this treasure. She asked me, along with three men I didn't even know, to go to this site, this location, and ascertain whether or not the military was actually harvesting the treasure. The location, which is called Victoria Peak, is in southern New Mexico. And she had heard that the military had jumped her claim on this treasure. Anyway, we went out there. We were actually trespassing on government property. I think I was only about 21 or 22 years old. I didn't know better anyway. But we got out there, and we did, in fact, see a lot of military activity, including heavy equipment, military officers, and enlisted men involved in recovering some stuff out of this out of a cave. We didn't get to see too much of it because we got caught and summarily ejected from the location.
You kind of talked your way out of that, though. You jumped right up and came up with a cover story.
Yeah, I had at various times I earned a little spending money by harvesting rattlesnake venom and selling it to a laboratory in Albuquerque. And I told the, when we were being interrogated by the military people, I told them that's what we were doing. We were looking for rattlesnakes to harvest the venom.
So after you get caught, you talk your way out, you see the military taking something out of this cave, the story gets out, it gets picked up. And I've heard this story before, at least part of it. I haven't heard your part, but the story about treasure at Victoria Peak, it gets into the newspapers, and this lady, Noss, she contacts her attorney. She presses it a little bit. She's trying to make the case, that's my treasure. And suddenly there's a lot of official inquiries into this, right?
Oh, indeed. It involved a number of politicians up to and including two or three presidents of the United States.
So how big was this treasure, this haul, this loot supposed to be? Millions?
If all of the reports are true, and if some of the hearsay is true, it probably amounted to in today's values, probably around $1 billion, if not more. There were caches of silver ingots, gold ingots, cut gems, a lot of precious stones, and a lot of historical artifacts. How all of this got in there, there are a number of theories. Some say it's Maximilian's treasure. Some claim it was treasure taken by the Apache chief Victorio from churches and wagon trains that he attacked and robbed and stored in there, and in turn used some of this wealth to trade for guns and ammunition. There are four or five theories relative to where all of this came from. There may be some truth to most of them. I've done a lot of research on this. I never did get to go back. I wish I could have. I never did get to go back, but I've done a lot of research and a lot of discussing with other people who have a great deal more intimacy with this than I did. And I'm putting together a book on this. It might be out in a couple of years, according to my agent. It'll be the most up-to-date version of where this treasure came from and what actually happened to it.
In your book, you write that in Albuquerque, you had to testify before a panel of six men, lawyers and military officers. So once this story gets out and the allegation is made that the military was taking something out of that cave, there's an official inquiry. And you, what'd you tell them? Did you tell them what you had seen?
I told them what I had seen, yeah.
Your guess is that whatever was going on there, that it was off the books, that maybe some officers or some military personnel had decided we're going to go in and grab that and not tell anybody about it.
That appears to be the case.
Because there's no trace of any of the stuff that was taken out, I guess, as far as you know.
There's some interesting circumstances. President Lyndon B. Johnson actually visited the site, and there are some threads that lead back to some of this Victoria Peak treasure. There's a possibility that some of that may have been responsible for some of Johnson's wealth.
Wow. There's a story that you tell about strap silver. What is strap silver? Describe that.
Strap silver is it's a thin ingot. It's the ones I've seen have been 6 to sometimes 10, 12 inches long. Fairly thin in the shape of a strap, a metal strap.
And this story is like literally right out of the Sierra Madre. I mean, it sounds like the treasure of the Sierra Madre because that's it's involved with that, right?
Well, they were that great book by the author B. Traven. They were prospecting. They were harvesting gold from streams or looking for a gold deposit in streams or in the rock. They weren't actually harvesting a lost or a buried treasure.
But you run into some guy who's got a couple of these straps and he's making bullets out of them. Is that how I remember it?
Right, yeah.
He didn't know it was silver.
No, he didn't. And I've come across this a lot in my 60 years of doing this, where people were harvesting what they thought was lead and making their own bullets, and it turns out that it was silver.
So you tell this guy, hey, hold on there, before you make more bullets, that's silver. Where'd you get it, right?
Right.
And that sets you off on this adventure to go find it. As he says, there's a whole bunch of it.
He took me to it was a series of caves in this canyon deep in the Sierra Madres, and he said there's hundreds of bars of lead that he picks up. He was a trapper. He trapped and skinned the animals and sold the furs, but he also harvested precious stones, and he would stop by this cave and grab a few of these small ingots, which he thought were lead. He would use them to make bullets for his rifle and for his handgun. And he took me there, and we encountered a phenomenal cache of silver ingots.
Well, yeah, it took a bad turn, too, this story. We'll continue it. We're talking with W.C. Jameson about his book, Treasure Hunter. We're talking with W.C. Jameson about his book, Treasure Hunter, a memoir of caches, curses, and confrontations. And I'll tell you, any one of these treasure stories would be an amazing adventure to talk about, to write about. But when you put them all together, it's amazing that W.C. is still alive. In a moment, we continue the story about these silver straps. It was not just legend. It wasn't just lore. They actually found the cave that had all this silver, and we're going to hear the rest of that in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. W.C. Jameson, so you're hunting for these silver straps with this guy named Reyes, and you go into some pretty rough country, have a variety of challenges, but eventually you find this cave where he said these things were stacked up, and you go inside. Describe what you find in there.
We find stacks like you would stack firewood of silver ingots, probably hundreds of them.
I mean, what would this be worth? You have a, can you even guess?
Well, it's hard to tell. A lot of these recoveries that we made in Mexico were silver and gold ingots that were processed by the Spaniards, whose skills relative to processing the gold or the silver ore into ingots was not as sophisticated as what we have now. So a lot of the gold bars and the silver bars that we found were only about 50 to 60, 65% gold or silver. The rest of it was a lot of impurities like lead, zinc, copper, none of which was worth nearly as much as the silver or the gold.
Right. So you thought these straps weighed about 7-8 pounds, something like that, each?
Something like that, yeah.
So you're out in the middle of nowhere. There can only be so many you can carry away. How many, what did you decide to do?
We grabbed a couple of handfuls and went. We rode into this area on horseback because it was fairly rough and it was a long way from any type of civilization. And civilization, in this case, were just nearby ranches. The closest town was many, many, many miles away. We grabbed a few handfuls. We were going to make several trips and load up our saddlebags as much as the horses could stand to carry and go back and see if we could broker these to somebody and gain enough cash to fund a little bit more sophisticated expedition in there and retrieve more.
So you crawl out of the cave, and to your horror, what do you find?
Well, we crawl out of the cave, and our riding stock, the horses that we came in there on, were gone. They had been frightened off by, we think, a mountain lion, which we had heard screaming the night before.
And then you confirm that at least one of those was killed by the mountain lion, or what
right.
looked like a mountain lion. Yeah. So there you are in the middle of nowhere. With these silver ingots, and you have no transportation anymore, what do you do?
Well, we had passed a ranch on the way into this canyon. It was, I'm going to guess, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 miles away, maybe a bit less. And our only choice was to hike out to the hike this ranch and see if we could borrow a couple of horses.
And carrying a lot of silver, are you tempted just to leave it behind?
Well, we buried some of it near our campsite. I think we each carried one of the straps in our belts.
So you start walking towards this ranch, and what happens?
Right. Well, my partner, Senor Reyes, I think, as I recall, his boots gave out on him. He he wound up being more or less barefoot because of the crappy boots that he had on, and we hit some rough terrain, and so. Hang out. We found a little sheltered area, and he decided to hang out there while I went on and tried to get some help and come back and retrieve him and retrieve more of the silver ingots.
So you walk a long way to this little town, and
right.
They're not able to offer much help, though, right?
Well, it was a ranching complex. It was a town only in the sense that there were probably about a dozen ranch hands, Mexican ranch hands, living in a little community there, adobe houses. But they were kind enough to lend us a couple of horses and actually escort us back to the location where I had left Reyes, and then back to the canyon.
You go, okay, so you get back there. Eventually you get back there, and what do you find?
We find Reyes. He was dead, and he had died from apparently a rattlesnake bite. Judging from the space between the fangs, it was a huge rattlesnake. We've encountered some incredibly large rattlesnakes in that part of the Sierra Madres, and he was a victim of one of them.
So he's dead. You had come back, I think, with two horses, right? One for you,
right.
One for him.
Right.
And you carry him out, or you buried him there?
Buried him there. The escort that we had a couple of ranch hands who were sent along just to, actually, I think mostly they wanted to make sure they got their horses back. But between us all, we took care of burying him right there.
Did you grab some of the silver? Did you not want to let them know where it was?
No, we had left. I'd left the. Reyes carried a bar, and I carried a bar, and we left him in this little, kind of a little overhang, a little rock overhang. That's not where he was. He had apparently tried to crawl his way out of the out of that area, and we found him some distance from that overhang. And after we buried him, I had no interest in going back. I kind of wanted to get out of there and make plans to come back another time.
So did you? Did you ever go back?
You know, I never did. Got back to civilization. I was doing some things. I was helping out on my dad's ranch, and I was working for other ranchers. I was loaned out to some ranchers in Mexico. I was also going to school, and I had some obligations along those lines. Was making plans to come back, but my treasure hunting partners had come up with some better plans, some more attractive treasures to perhaps go in search of. And I did wind up going back to that area, trying to find my way back to that area several years later, but so much had changed. I had a hard time finding the canyon. There were new roads in there. The ranches had expanded. There was a little ejido established there. Ejido was kind of a government-sponsored agricultural commune that had sprung up, seemed like almost overnight. And nothing much looked the same, and I had spent a lot of time looking for. I'm usually good at this, but I could not find the canyon. But we had other projects going that seemed more promising, and so we devoted our attention to those.
Just a side note, there are difficulties. You get treasure in Mexico. There are difficulties about getting it back into this country. I would imagine that today, if you were to try it, you'd have a heck of a problem getting it back.
Well, you if you go through the what we would regard as the proper channels, you won't get it back. The Mexicans are not too crazy about gringos running off with their artifacts or anything else for that matter. So we don't tell anybody.
I mean, that's sort of a common theme for a treasure hunter like you is you're actually, and you admit it in the book, you basically, when you've found things, it's probably illegal. I mean, what you've taken away is illegal.
The truth is, yeah, most people have this perception of what I do as something that Indiana Jones would do. And it's a far cry from that. Most of what I do is illegal. I am either trespassing, and if you find a cache of something on private property or federal or state property and you remove it, then technically that is stealing. And if you find it in a foreign country and bring it back over here, then that is smuggling. All of this is frowned upon. But if you go through the normal channels, go through a regular border crossing and declare that you've got 18 bars of gold or silver, it's going to be confiscated right on the spot. You're not going to get to keep it.
It's the same kind of thing you read about. Okay, somebody found a sunken Spanish galleon or some shipwreck off the coast of this country or that country. Whenever you read those stories, the government comes in. If the find is public, the government's got a piece of it. The partners have a piece of it.
Anytime there's any kind of significant money involved, the politicians will get involved with it also.
I would imagine there's competition. There's other people like you, and you don't want them getting wind of any kind of that you're on the trail of something, right?
You know, I've encountered a little bit of that. There's such a thing as treasure pirates. These are people that will, we've had experiences where people have followed us or tried to follow us into a location that we had been working. We had been harvesting some ingots from a large cache, and mostly we were successful in just simply losing them, and they never got anything, at least that we know of. I think this is much more common in shallow water recovery, where people will move in in their boats and their diving gear, and while the company or the individual or the group that had actually found a sunken wreck and were harvesting some stuff from it. When they would go in to refuel or resupply and everything else, the pirates would head out to that location and take what they could in the time that the other group was gone. We haven't suffered any from that I'm aware of.
You know, you think that, well, gosh, how many treasure stories are there to go around? How many lost treasures, lost mines are there? But when you think about the riches in the American West, the New World, how much gold and silver was being moved around and mined and then moved around, caravan, ship, things of that sort. There was a heck of a lot that got lost, right?
Oh, there was. The truth is, among the professional treasure hunters that I have met over the years, I found them a fairly agreeable bunch. Most of them are dead now. I'm like one of the last ones alive. My three partners that I worked with for over three decades are all gone now. And I've got a new partner I'm working with. We're involved in some recovery operations right now. But my experience has been the ones that I've known, half a dozen to a dozen or so, we look at it as we're sort of all in this together, and we were happy to share information. We were happy to provide leads. We were happy to, if there was a project that we couldn't get to because we were busy with something else, we had no problems at all with sharing this information with some of our comrades in this what is an incredibly goofy pursuit, is treasure hunting.
Goofy because it's risky, it's dangerous, it's there's a lot of wasted time in that you chase rumors and stories and don't find stuff, right?
Sure, there's like I said, there are more failures than there are successes, but in just about every case, we've always had an adventure, we've always learned something. We've had a lot of these adventures where there was a great deal of risk involved. But I always looked at risk as the sweetener. We got to where we would anticipate it. We would look forward to it.
The three guys who become your partners and who you share several adventures in this book with, how did you hook up with them, and who were they?
One of them I met at a flea market where we were both looking at somebody had a – this was a flea market in Mexico. It was a flea market where most of the wares that people were selling were spread out on the ground, and among those wares were about a half a dozen silver ingots that somebody was trying to sell. And a man who was a university professor from a Midwestern university, he and I arrived at this one particular location at the same time, and we got to discussing silver, lost silver, searching for silver, and so on. And we kind of teamed up. He was, in truth, the brains of this quartet. He often got these research grants where he would go to Mexico City and spend a great deal of time in the libraries and in the monasteries, the archives in the monasteries, and he would come across these accounts of pack trains transporting gold or silver from mines, mostly in New Mexico, Arizona, sometimes Texas. This was all harvested by, under the influence of the Spanish. It was done with Indian slaves, by the way, captured Indians who were forced to work in the mines, processed into ingots, loaded onto mules or burros, and then transported back to government or church headquarters in Mexico City. Back then, government and church headquarters were basically the same thing.
Hmm. So this guy, the professor, he's sort of the Indiana Jones of your group, the academic.
Well, he was, like I said, he was the brains. Another guy was from Britain, Great Britain, and he had come across some references, I think a magazine article or a newspaper article about some stuff I was doing relative to this. And he just invited himself over and found him a congenial sort of fellow with a great passion for doing this. So we went out on a couple of expeditions, and I found him to be quite helpful. You know, different people go into an area, the same area, they look at it differently. And some people are really good at diagnosing the geography, the drainage patterns, the mineralization, and other things. And he was one of these guys. He was good at this.
And the other guy,
the third partner was a He was a Marine veteran. He was a good expedition hand. He was into it for the adventure.
He's a handy guy to have along, because a lot of the situations you get in get pretty pretty hairy.
Yeah, he was usually the first one to shoot back when we got shot in.
And that happened more than once.
Oh yeah, yeah. We often found ourselves in situations where we probably shouldn't have been to begin with. We stumbled onto confrontations between different interests in the Sierra Madres. For example, one of the worst was the timber companies were clear cutting, harvesting timber, and they were moving into lands that had been populated by the indigenous people there. They'd lived there for thousands and thousands of years, and the timber companies were going in and just clear cutting and chasing, moving the Indians out, just telling them they needed to get out. And when the Indians decided they weren't going to do that, the timber companies sent in mercenaries to remove them. And so you wound up with a kind of a warfare going on. It's still going on, by the way. There's a lot of places back there we can't get into because this problem between the timber companies, all of which, by the way, are American-owned, the timber companies and the indigenous Indians is still going on, except now they're fighting it out with AK-47s and helicopters and things instead of machetes and handguns like they were back when we were there.
Well, I imagine a lot of drug smuggler types are in these areas with guns as well. The same areas where you'd be looking for treasure.
Right. In fact, the drug cartels have been arming the Indians, from what we've learned.
When you read this whole book, you think this guy must be set. That you wouldn't need financially, you wouldn't need to look for treasure anymore. But you still do it, apparently, based on this conversation. That's more for the adventure than anything.
Yeah. Plus, I like the money. here's the truth. I mentioned before, a lot of times these recovery is a whole lot more difficult than discovery. You can discover a cache of 400 gold ingots, but if you're on foot and you're backpacking, you're only going to be able to carry out one or two, depending on the size, one or two at a time. You can't go into these areas with large pack trains. You can't go. A lot of people say, why don't you just go in with a helicopter? You don't want to do anything to attract attention to what you were doing, because then you're going to have problems and you're probably going to lose the opportunity to continue your recovery operations.
We're going to take a break. When we would recover the
gold and the silver, I mentioned before that a lot of times, even though it may weigh 20 pounds, only about 50 to 65% of that was the actual ore. And so we carry heavy stuff out, but we wouldn't get, if it's a 20-pound ingot, we wouldn't get compensated for 20 pounds worth of gold. It would be considerably less. Then we would have to divide it four ways and then pay ourselves back for our expenses and then fund the next trip.
W.C. Jameson, Treasure Hunter, is the name of the book. In a moment, I'm going to tell you about a story about some gold that was in some sand dunes, the Paloma sand dunes, that intersected with his father's property. We're going to the break with a classic from Creedence Clearwater, Lodi.